This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
SLED recovered DNA from underneath Maggie Murtaugh's fingernails at the crime scene. They tested it. They determined it belonged to an unknown male, no relation to the Murtaugh family. And then, according to defense filings dated July 30th of 2026, they stopped. Didn't try to figure out who it was. Didn't send it anywhere else. Didn't flag it for further analysis. Maggie Murtaugh was shot to death, by the way, and somebody else's DNA was under her fingernails. And the state agency investigating her murder wrote it down and moved on. Cross your T's, dot your I's. We talk about this all the time on this show. This is how so many cases fall apart, not because the accused is innocent, but because the investigation fails upon thorough review. We're going to get into some of these arguments that are being made as there is a civil case going on with Alec Murtaugh involving Becky Hill. And there's also the retrial that we're gearing up for next year. If you follow court cases, as we do here every single day, you'll know that a majority, in fact, some of the biggest pieces of a trial happen before the trial actually takes place. The decisions that are made, the witnesses, the arguments, the evidence that's allowed in, that's not allowed in, the investigative routes they're allowed to go down or not go down, all of that is litigated before the trial actually started, and that's what's going on right now. But Alec Murtaugh was already found guilty of murder. Doesn't matter. That's been wiped clean. It's as if it never happened. So they are starting from the ground up on the defense of Alec Murtaugh. That's how this works, and that's what we are talking about. I certainly welcome your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to dive deep into this case. The defense wants an independent lab to test what's left of that sample. SLED, the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, basically it's like the state's FBI, if you will, the state version of the FBI, is fighting to run their own tests first using the same method that already failed to identify anyone. The defense says that process could consume or degrade the evidence before anyone else gets a shot at it. The defense also says they've watched SLED handle evidence in this case before, that the details of what happened are documented. That involves a white T-shirt, a blood spatter expert who changed his mind after a visit from the lead investigator, Photoshop, and a SLED captain who allegedly ordered her own people to bury results. We'll get there. Alec Murtaugh's murder convictions were overturned by the South Carolina Supreme Court after former Colleton County Clerk Becky Hill was caught making prejudicial comments to jurors. The system that was supposed to protect the trial broke it instead. Retrial set for April 5th of 2027. New judge Deborah McCaslin. Next pretrial hearing is August 14th. The defense has also filed a motion to move the trial out of the 14th Judicial Circuit entirely. Their argument, the Murtaugh name has been synonymous with the local legal system for nearly a century. Alec's father, grandfather, and great-grandfather were all elected solicitors in that circuit. The population is small and interconnected. The documentaries, books, and films that shape public opinion about this case were researched, filmed, and produced right there. The defense, Harpootlin, Griffin, Barber, Fox, and Hand is building a very different case this time around. They say they're bringing up to 8 new expert witnesses. At the center of all this is the fight over Maggie's fingernail DNA. The defense wants the remaining reserve sample sent to Ortham, Inc., a forensic genetic genealogy lab out of the Woodlands, Texas. This is the lab that helped put a name to Brian Koberger in the Idaho student murder, same lab that cracked the lady of the Dunes cold case after nearly 50 years. A woman found dead in the sand dunes of Provincetown, Massachusetts in 1974, finally identified as Ruth Mary Terry. Ortham's technology was used in the Rachel Mooring case in Maryland and to identify one of the women connected to Gilgo Beach. When law enforcement DNA testing hits a wall, Ortham is where the hard cases go. Almost sounds like a commercial. When law enforcement needs DNA testing, when it hits a wall, Ortham is where the hard cases go. And when you want Ortho to clean the bugs out of your home, it's a totally different spelling, totally Ortham versus, yeah, anyway. We see Ortham used all the time. It's a good lab. The reason Ortham matters here is because SLED's method already hit that wall. SLED runs STR testing, short tandem repeat analysis. It checks DNA against known criminal databases like CODIS. They ran it on Maggie's fingernail sample, got a partial profile, too incomplete to submit to CODIS, so it was a dead end. That's where they left it. Ortham uses a fundamentally different technology, SNP testing is what it's called. They can pull usable information from degraded or trace DNA that STR can't touch, and it checks against public genealogy databases, not just the criminal system. That's a technology that identified Koberger, because his parents weren't in the system, but they identified him through the genetic genealogy, which, by the way, whether you've ever filled one of those things out or not from 23andMe or Ancestry, or you're in there. That's how it works. If you have a family member that's done it in any sort of circle near you, you're in there. Or you can be traced. That's how genetic genealogy works. It's like, it's the full picture. It's the full coverage. Remember back in the day? Some of you will, some of you won't, depending how old you are. When cell phone technology, this is really only about 20 years ago, where you had good coverage, it would be like kind of along highways in major cities. And if you were out in the boonies a little bit, like there just wasn't a lot of coverage. There were some carriers that carried like analog coverage out there. This is like that. Your other testing, your STR testing, that's the highways. That's where you're going to check what's on there. That's your criminals that are already in the system. This, we can go out, the genetic genealogy, that's checking everything. Not just somebody that's on the highway. It's checking the overlay. And if that person is related to somebody that the DNA shows, you can go talk to that person and find out why they might have their DNA under Maggie Murtaugh's fingernails. And there are logical, explainable ways that are not criminal for that to have happened. There are. But when you're talking about murder, it's good to run all that down and make sure we're not talking about something that's not innocent. The defense is saying something simple. Your method failed. Ours might work. Let us go first. Both methods consume sample material. If SLED runs theirs again on what's left for no scientific reason, since it already came back incomplete, there's a real risk. You don't really need to run it again. You did. The evidence could be degraded or exhausted before the lab might actually produce a name to ever touch it. The defense's own words, there's no scientific justification for the state's preferred testing sequence. The only apparent effect of letting SLED go first, they wrote, is to consume irreplaceable sample material before Ortham has the opportunity to test it. The state's answer is worth hearing on its own terms. Prosecutors say the unknown profile is too partial and incomplete to mean anything. Well, why don't you let Ortham decide that, not your own conjecture? They say trace DNA under fingernails doesn't necessarily suggest a struggle, and it doesn't. Maggie had her nails done the same day she was killed. Touch DNA transfers through casual contact, a steering wheel, a doorknob, something at the salon. Prosecutors call the defense's request an exercise in public consumption, not forensic science. Well, you can call it anything you want, but how about we just actually test and see what happens? And if it turns out to be somebody from the nail salon that had nothing, then that's what it is. Then that's what it is. Question answered. Not an open, loose end of, well, here's what I think it's going to be. You know, it's like your dad telling you,
Here's, nah, don't do it. And then I get it. I do it all the time with my daughter. But sometimes you just got to let people live. You got to let them go down the path of whatever they're going to do and experience the cause and effect and learn from themselves what exactly that means. Because sometimes someone just sitting there, nah, it'll just turn out like this. It'll just turn out. Well, you know what? Most of the world wants to actually get the answer, not just what your conjecture says. Because every once in a while, dad's wrong. And the assumption of, well, that's what it's be, because it usually is, isn't always right. And we're talking about, you know, murder. Maybe we should just cross those T's and dot those I's. Call me crazy. Maybe they're right. Maybe it is trace transfer from a nail salon door handle. But if that's the case, then letting Ortham test it costs the prosecution nothing. A confirmed casual transfer result kills the defense's alternate suspect theory before it's born. A name that traces back to a salon employee or a random point of contact is one more thing for the state to point at and dismiss. So this could totally work in your favor, prosecution. The only scenario where blocking this test helps the prosecution as if the result might not be meaningless. Nobody from the state has explained why a confident prosecution would fight to prevent a test that can only strengthen their position if they're right. Harpootlin said it plainly. They decided the night of the murders that Alec was their guy. And everything they did after that point excluded any other possibility. I don't know. I don't know that I agree with that assertion either. So I think if they thought he was their guy, he would have been arrested that night. He wasn't. He wasn't arrested for a long time. I think they thought early on it couldn't have possibly been him. Why they didn't do a thorough investigation doesn't make a lot of sense either. But the defense's character, that's the defense's characterization. They're not just saying it. They're pointing to a documented pattern in the same investigation. And the pattern involves a white T-shirt. Alec was wearing a white T-shirt the night they say he found Maggie and Paul. Sled collected it in August of 21. They ran hematrace testing on the stained areas. Hematrace is designed specifically to confirm human blood. It's sensitive enough to detect as little as 4 micrograms. Do you know how little 4 micrograms is? Neither do I, but it sounds pretty small. Every area of the shirt came back negative. No human blood. 6 weeks after those results, 6 weeks after every tested area came back clean, Sled brought it to Tom Bevel, a blood spatter analyst out of Oklahoma. And according to defense filings, they never gave Bevel the negative hematrace results. He was asked to evaluate a shirt for blood spatter without being told the shirt had already tested negative for blood. Bevel's first report in February 2022 said the stains on the shirt were not consistent with blood spatter. They were consistent with transfer stains, which is exactly what you'd expect if Alec touched the bodies after finding them, which he told the 911 operator he did. Then Sled's lead investigator, David Owen, visited Bevel in person. After that visit, Bevel reversed his conclusion completely. The shirt itself was already gone. Sled had conveniently destroyed it by spraying it with a chemical called Lusocrystal Violet, LCV, is supposed to help identify blood stains, but it also reacts to laundry detergent. Might need a different chemical, guys. Well, it's either a murder scene or, gosh, that Tide with Oxy sure is cleaning up the shirts good this week. Eventually, it turns the entire fabric purple and wipes out all the original details. So Bevel worked from photographs instead. He used Photoshop to filter the colors, and he came back saying he'd found over 100 stains consistent with high-velocity blood spatter from a shotgun wound. Same evidence. Opposite conclusion after a visit from lead investigators. Yeah. And the physical shirt that could have settled the question? Gone. Nobody could re-examine it. Nobody could run an independent test. The only thing they were left were photographs and a revised opinion. That revised opinion, the one that claimed high-velocity blood spatter, was instrumental in securing the murder indictments against Alec Murdaugh. The grand jury heard about spatter on his clothing. It convicted him in the court of public opinion months before the trial even started. Oh, it gets worse. And look, I'm not a pro Alec Murdaugh person, but the more I dig into this case, the more I hear about the non-crossing of T's and dotting of I's, the more I'm like, the hell is going on here? And it might be incompetent investigation. That really, incompetence oftentimes can mask itself and look like conspiracy. It gets worse, though. According to the defense's July 30th filing, Sledge head of forensic administration, Captain Emily Reinhart, responded to the original negative hematrace results by directing her people to stop running hematrace tests on other items in the case and to suppress the exculpatory results they'd already produced. Sledge never gave those results to Bevel before he revised his opinion, never disclosed them to the expert they specifically hired to evaluate the shirt for blood. When the blood spatter theory collapsed at trial, the state pivoted. New argument: Alec must have been wearing a different shirt during the killings and changed into the white t-shirt afterward. The shirt they'd built part of their indictment around suddenly wasn't the relevant shirt. Test came back exculpatory. Evidence gets destroyed. Results allegedly get buried. Story changes. That's the pattern the defense is pointing to. And they're saying, there's one remaining DNA sample under Maggie Murdaugh's fingernail. The lab that cracks some of the biggest DNA cases in the country wants to test it. Sled wants to go first with the same method that already produced nothing on this exact sample. And the defense says that method can consume or degrade what's left before Ortham ever gets a chance. And they already tested it. So why do you need a second scoop of ice cream? The defense filed their memorandum asking McCaslin to book Sled or block Sled from going first. In their own words, Sled's conduct regarding other biological evidence in this case gives further cause to doubt that it acts in good faith. The sanctions motion related to the t-shirt is still outstanding from the first trial. It's never been resolved. Nobody's out here crying for Alec Murdaugh. I want to be clear about that. He's a convicted financial criminal who stole roughly $12 million from his own clients and the families of people who trusted him. He stole settlement money from the family of his own housekeeper after she died on his property. He stole from people who came to his law firm because the Murdaugh name was the most powerful one in the Low Country. He's serving 27 years state and 40 years federal for those crimes. He's going to prison for a long time. He is in prison for a long time, no matter what happens with the murder charges. The kennel video allegedly placed him at the scene minutes before the killings. His own statements created timeline problems. He lied to investigators early on and admitted it. None of that is in dispute. But none of that answers the questions either. If the state's case is as strong as they've always said, then the test makes it stronger. A nail salon transfer gets confirmed. The defense's alternate suspect play dies on the table. Someone with no connection to any crime gets identified. Same outcome. The only way this test threatens the prosecution is if the result points somewhere they never looked. That's the thread running through the whole case right now. The first trial didn't fall apart because of the evidence. It fell apart because of the system, a clerk who tampered with the jury. Now the defense is arguing a different part of that same system has been mishandling the evidence from the start. That Sled found unknown male DNA on a woman who'd been shot to death and chose not to pursue it. That they allegedly suppressed test results on a key piece of physical evidence and then destroyed it. That their own forensic leadership allegedly told subordinates to stop generating results that didn't fit the state's theory. Whether any of that holds up is for McCaslin and eventually a jury to decide. The August 14th pretrial hearing is where the DNA testing question is expected to land. McCaslin's already said she wants to know how long Ortham's testing would take. That suggests she's weighing it. Maggie Murdaugh was 52 years old. She was a mother. She was killed by gunfire alongside her 22-year-old son at the property they had been in. The family for generations. Somebody's DNA was found under her fingernails that night. Didn't belong to her husband. Didn't belong to her son. Didn't belong to anyone in her family. 5 years later, nobody's tried to find out whose it was. That sample is either going to get tested by the lab that's identified people law enforcement couldn't name for decades, or it's going to be consumed by the same agency that allegedly destroyed the t-shirt and buried the results. If Alec Murdaugh did it, the test confirms it. If he didn't, it's the only physical evidence that might point to whoever did. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. You can completely hate Alec Murdaugh and want this test to be done. I, for one, am one of those people. Test away. What does more information do? It certainly does not hurt. The only thing it can hurt is a narrative. And a narrative is not a fact. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We will continue our conversation right there. If you've not already done so, take our podcast with you wherever you go. Yes. If you're sitting there like, I love watching this, but in the car, turn on the podcast. Hitting Killers with Tony Bruschi. QR code is on the screen right there. Scan it. Takes you to whatever podcast player you like. Hit subscribe. And boom, there you go. We're with you. We do appreciate that. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Alec Murdaugh's lawyer sued Becky Hill for $600,000. Murdaugh says that money came out of his retirement account to pay for his first murder trial. The dollar figure made the headline when they filed it in May of 2026, 5 days after his conviction was thrown out. And I mean, think about it for a second. You take all the shittiness of Alec Murdaugh out of the conversation. You just spent $600,000 on attorneys for a trial that still got you locked up. And then the court goes and says, we're actually going to throw that whole thing out. We're going to do this all over again. Well, what about that $600 I just spent on a trial that went horribly sideways because it was beyond my control because one of your officials poisoned the pond? I got some damages over here that I need to be made whole on again because I got to fund more attorneys for this second round. Now, for Alec Murdaugh, it's a blessing that he's getting a new trial, and that's for Alec Murdaugh to feel that way. But the reality is, it's not Alec Murdaugh, it's somebody else in that sort of situation, and the institution poisons the well of which you're forced to drink out of. And they realize, oh, shit, one of our people poisoned this well. We got to go back and do this all over again. Is it the responsibility of the person who was forced to drink out of the well to pay again to go back to that same well and drink out of? I mean, it's... I kind of understand this lawsuit here. Now, the law may not agree with how fundamental that works, but I think it's kind of got a point there. The suit carried two tools that mattered more than the money. Subpoena power. It was more about that than it was the actual money. But I do think he has a point to the money, and I wouldn't mind seeing Becky Hill being forced to cough up $600,000. But subpoena power was really the big thing here. Subpoena power means the defense could legally force people to hand over emails, text messages, and phone records. Deposition authority also there means they could sit a person in a chair under oath and question them for hours. Lying in that chair is a new crime. That's what that lawsuit was all about. Jim Griffin, one of Murdaugh's lawyers, even said the purpose out loud at the press conference. The suit existed, in his words, to investigate exactly what she did. Then he asked the question on the record, did she act alone? That's part of the fishing expedition that they were out for. And they can only really get it by suing Becky Hill, by sitting others down in depositions, to get them on the record on the questions they asked. And then when that trial comes along, totally different trial, these are two totally different lawsuits, then they could take that information. And if somebody gives a slightly different answer or that they view as being slightly contradictory or off, that's impeaching them on the stand. And see, they told us that there. You're saying this here now. How can we trust anything you're saying? And thus, you have reasonable doubt. That is kind of in a nutshell what the attorneys for Alec Murdaugh were trying to do by pulling the lever of the $600,000 lawsuit against Becky Hill. And we're going to get into all of this, how this works, because on August 5th of 26, Federal District Judge Richard Gergel in Charleston dismissed the case in 5 pages. The investigation died with it 8 months before the jury selection. So that lever they were going to pull to try and help the defense of Alec Murdaugh in trial number 2, oh, it just got put back into place. The retrial starts April 5th of 2027 in Lexington County. Judge Deborah McCaslin has the case, and she has told both sides she intends to keep that date. The state is retrying the same 4 counts, 2 of murder and 2 of weapons possession. The attorney general has said the death penalty is on the table this round. Murdaugh's lawyers have ruled out any sort of plea deal. In Harpudlin's words at the June status conference, off the table, we want a trial. The first trial, of course, was held at the courthouse in Waterboro and ended in March of 23 with a conviction. Murdaugh arrived at the June hearing for the retrial in an orange jumpsuit and chains. Becky Hill was the Colleton County clerk who managed the jury at the first trial. Jurors testified she told them to watch Murdaugh's actions and warned them not to be fooled by his lawyers. One juror called Juror Z in the record testified those comments made her believe he was guilty before deliberations even began. Hill was arrested then in May of 25 and pled guilty that December to obstruction, perjury, and misconduct in office. Her sentence was 3 years of probation, and through her lawyers, Hill denied ever tampering with the jury, even as she admitted to other charges. The jury contact was one piece of her record. Hill admitted she showed sealed crime scene photographs to journalists and then lied about it under oath. She admitted she skimmed bonus money from public accounts. She's a real, you know, on the up and up type folks. She also published a book about the trial while the appeal was still pending, using the biggest case of her career as material. She ended up resigning from the clerk's office in March of 24 and has held no public position since. In May of 26, the South Carolina Supreme Court threw out Murdaugh's conviction by a 5-0 vote. The justices wrote that Hill placed her fingers on the scales of justice. Their ruling erased the murder convictions and the weapons counts along with them. Attorney General Alan Wilson answered the ruling the same day. His office said they would aggressively seek to retry Murdaugh as soon as possible. Once contact, like Hill's, with the jury was shown, the state had to prove it caused no harm, and they couldn't. That ruling settled the tampering for good. The court already gave Murdaugh everything Hill's conduct could give him, which is a new trial, proving that what she did all over again is really worth nothing in front of the next jury. One piece of the first trial does stay unresolved. During deliberations, a juror was removed from the panel over an anonymous email. 3 years later, the sender has never been identified. So the lawsuit's value sat in what its investigation could produce for April of 27. Take Griffin at his word. There were 4 things on his list. The tools only existed inside the lawsuit because of how criminal cases work. A criminal defendant gets discovery from the state, meaning the prosecution turns over its file. Hill's personal emails, texts, phone records were never in that original file. His lawyers also can't force a private citizen to answer their questions. So suing her changed the rules because a civil defendant can be subpoenaed and deposed. The first thing on this list was leads that point at someone other than Alec. That was the whole goal of this. The defense's job at a retrial is reasonable doubt, and its opening, it's already on file. Sled found unknown male DNA under Maggie's fingernails and never pursued it. The defense wants that DNA run through genetic genealogy, which means tracing it through family tree databases towards a name. Sled never took it that far, and the murder weapons have never been found. Civil discovery could reach people and records the murder case can't touch. Any name or dropped lead surfacing in those depositions becomes something the defense can chase or subpoena into the criminal case. One was helping the other. In the minds of Alec Murdaugh's attorney, a someone else story It needs facts behind it. And the suit was built to go find them. Yeah, like OJ on a golf course. The second thing was the answer to Griffin's question. Hill's records plus depositions of the people around her would either end the story at one clerk or show that there was some sort of coordination. More people were, I guess, egging Becky along, allegedly, to do this. And if there was somebody doing that, who and why? And what connection did they have to Murdaugh? If anyone connected to the state's sides touched that jury. Legal analysts have noted that that supports a motion to dismiss the charges for government misconduct. In plain English, that's the argument that the state doesn't get a second try at. The case is rigged by its own people. Hill herself has never answered questions under oath in the open. Her plea deal ended her criminal case without a trial, so there was no witness stand and no cross-examination. The state's investigators questioned her behind closed doors and closed the file. Hill's son, remember him? Colleton County's technology department person. He was running that until 2023 when he was charged with using his position to secretly record a phone call between county employees. Whether anything in that building connected to the jury was a question that only depositions could ask. The coordination idea stays the defense's theory. Without a record behind it, the anonymous email sat on the same target list, and tracing the sender either closes a loose end or opens a much bigger one. The third thing was sworn statements to carry into the retrial, a deposition. It works like this. A witness sits across from the other side's lawyers and swears to tell the truth. Then they question her for hours on the record. Every answer gets transcribed and kept, and they could get more people than her. They could reach SLED agents, courthouse staff, the people who investigated Hill herself, all of them on the record before the retrial starts, people who might go on the record in the Alec Murdaugh trial. Every courthouse employee and investigator the defense deposed would be locked into one story, testify differently at the murder trial. The defense reads the old transcript back in front of the jury, and lawyers, well, they call that impeachment, which means catching a witness contradicting their own sworn words. And when reasonable doubt is what you're going for, people that are appearing to be caught in a lie or a mistruth or not quite fessing up to everything, juries don't like that. Few things damage a prosecution more inside a courtroom. The lawsuit would have stocked the defense with transcripts before a single retrial witness took the stand so they could know what was going to be said and they could be ready to pounce the second anything sounded different or off, and that could be anything. If they could go, see? How do we trust anything you're saying? It's a tactic. The fourth thing was a sworn record of how SLED handled the tampering probe. At Hill's sentencing, the prosecutor told the court there wasn't enough evidence to charge her with jury tampering. The judge told Hill her sentence would have been harsher if there had been. Five justices at the Supreme Court then looked at the same conduct and found it bad enough to erase the double murder conviction. The tampering probe belonged to SLED, and the murder case belongs to SLED. Depositions could force those investigators to explain the gap under oath. Every thin answer becomes cross-examination material, feeding the same argument as the untested DNA. This agency leaves things unexamined. It's a strategy. The prosecution has an answer to all of it, though, and the answer carries some real weight. The kennel video recorded on Paul's own phone puts Murdaugh's voice at the crime scene minutes before Maggie and Paul were killed. He had told investigators he was never there. Murdaugh took the stand at the first trial and denied the killings. Confronted with the kennel video, then he admitted, "Oh, I lied to investigators about being at the scene." Blamed the lie on paranoia from his opioid addiction. And, you know, that may actually be true. Prosecutors allege the motive was roughly $12 million in client theft. Starting to surface around him, the first jury heard 76 witnesses across 6 weeks and convicted in under 3 hours. From the state's chair, none of that evidence runs through Becky Hill's inbox. The lawsuit, in that view, was a fishing expedition. Its purpose was putting the system on trial instead of the actual defendant. Hill's lawyers had asked the judge to throw the case out. Their argument was that she never caused the harm Murdaugh claimed. Judge Gergel's ruling never picked between those two views of the lawsuit. His five pages turned on a simpler question. A grand jury indicted Alec Murdaugh in July of 22. The attorney general's office prosecuted him. He was hiring lawyers and draining that retirement account no matter what Becky Hill did during the trial. The murder charges created his legal bills, and she didn't create the murder charges. Interesting way of looking at things. The rule underneath is one anybody can follow. You can only sue somebody for harm they actually caused you. The harm Hill caused was a corrupted trial, and the harm Murdaugh sued over was the cost of defending against murder charges. That's where the $600,000 comes back in. The money claim was the flaw in the design. His lawyers hung an entire investigation on an injury that the court is saying, by law, Hill didn't cause. Gergel called that missing link the fatal flaw in the case. The phrase is his, straight from the order. Murdaugh's team pointed to court decisions letting defendants recover legal fees from officials who launched baseless prosecutions. Gergel wrote that those cases didn't fit because Hill didn't launch anything. And law, the ruling holds up. A judge applied a causation rule the way it's written, and nothing about it reads as a favor to anyone. The court never called the defense's questions legitimate or illegitimate either. The dismissal still closed all four doors at once. Agree with it, disagree with it. The door got shut. The leads stay unfounded, and the fingernail DNA stands alone without an investigation around it. The acted alone answer stays unknown. The transcripts were never created, and Sledge's explanations stay off the record. What the defense brings to April 2027 instead is the public record everyone already has. Two facts keep the fight alive past the dismissal. Gergel threw the case out without prejudice, which means Murdaugh is allowed to refile. And in a footnote, the judge noted that Murdaugh's lawyers deliberately left out the costs of the retrial, since those costs don't exist yet. He added that his ruling says nothing about a future claim built on them. So, more so room for, okay, you spent all that money here, and now you're going to have to spend more money again to defend yourself. Because you have to spend that more money to defend yourself, that right there may be a bill that lands on Becky Hill's desk. But the first one, by the letter of the law, not so much. I don't know that I necessarily agree with that judge. I don't know that other judges necessarily would agree with that. But it is what it is. It's the decision that was made. The retrial's legal bills will exist for exactly one reason, and that reason is Becky Hill. There's no second trial without what she did. A refiled suit on those costs would have the causation this one lacked. But other than just recovering the funds, by the time that takes place, after a second trial, the levers of subpoena and deposition and all that, more so deposition, don't really have as much of a purpose anymore because that trial will be done. So timing is everything. The defense also appealed within hours, asking the Fourth Circuit to overturn the causation ruling. That court is a federal appeals bench over South Carolina, and its cases commonly run a year or longer. The refiled version can't exist until the retrial creates its own bills. Neither track finishes before jury selection in April, unless, of course, they push the trial out, which could happen. None of this makes Alec Murdaugh sympathetic. He stole roughly $12 million from his own clients, including the family of Gloria Satterfield, the housekeeper who died after a fall at the Murdaugh home. He's serving 40 years federal plus 27 state for the thefts, and those sentences hold no matter how the retrial ends. Maggie Murdaugh was 52. Split her time between the family's hunting property and their beach house in Modesto, and she raised two sons. Paul was her younger boy, 22. Buster, the surviving son, sat behind his father, through the first trial. We'll watch a second jury weigh the same questions. Maggie and Paul were shot to death at the family's Colleton County property in June of 21. The trial that decides who killed them needs a verdict no court ever unwinds. It starts in 8 months. The defense's investigation ended before it asks its first question under oath. What are your thoughts on all of Murtaugh's saga here? There's a lot in there, isn't there? It's a case that is troubling because there's element. You can be sympathetic and understand the law and understand what is right and wrong. And sometimes wrong law can be applied to wrong people and vice versa, and mix and match this any which way you want. At the end of the day, it doesn't change that person is a horrible human being or a wrong person. But that's the point of the law. The law is not supposed to be the one in the wrong. The law is supposed to be the one holding up the right, the pillar of right, the pillar of justice for whoever is going in front of it. Alec Murtaugh or Mr. Rogers? You want the same equal scales of justice for whoever is in front of it without one side being pushed down for this reason or that. But as we know, if you follow true crime, it rarely ever pans out that way. Again, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue our conversation there. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.